I've loved his work for many years now. I mean, back in the late 90s, I used to get postcards from him when he was, before he was famous, and he, you know, he would hear about our getting arrested in the Disney store up in Times Square, you know, he would identify with that, you know, because Miami's like that. Miami's kind of like Las Vegas East, and it's crazy out here. Disney has trashed the entire state. But I don't know, you know, as much as we're working on Monsanto, and I feel like I'm breathing Monsanto toxins as we speak, I don't know the details so much, and I really can't talk with authority about what's happened in the Everglades. We're going to meet an old family friend who's a park ranger.
Reverend Billy, I'm getting angry signals
from him.
I'm getting angry signals from my engineer. We have to go now. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Come back in 2 weeks with the album. We've been speaking with Reverend Billy, the Church of Stop Shopping Choir. This is Air Cascadia for Monday, December 28th. Kate Welch, engineered the show for us. Thanks, Kate Kathleen Stevenson's a KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Are you still looking for a way to fit KBOO into your year-end giving? KBOO Community Radio is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. For the past 11 years, the Give Guide has raised nearly $13 million for hundreds of local nonprofits. Help us reach our $20,000 goal and look KBOO up on the giveguide.org website. And make a donation today before December 31st. Remember, we have a one-to-one match for all new and increasing donations too. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of WOMBA, Friday, January 1st, 2016, at 9 p.m. at the Analog Cafe in Portland. WOMBA is an African-inspired fusion band featuring improvisation with heavy African percussion breaks. The eight-piece band mixes traditional rhythms from Ghana and West Africa with Afrobeat, highlife, funk, and jazz styles. Again, that's WOMBA performing live Friday, January 1st, at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Just before the Christmas recess, Congress passed a budget resolution that includes an amendment to lift the ban on exporting crude oil. Lifting the ban puts that much more pressure on the Pacific Northwest from the fossil fuel industry, which wants to turn the region into a hub for exporting fossil fuels. This morning, we'll look back at the past year's actions to stave off this pressure and protect the thin green line of resistance. My guest is Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper. We'll review this past year of climate action in the face of the fossil fuel industry's aggressive plans to build oil, coal, LNG, and liquid propane terminals across the Northwest. Dan, welcome back to Locus Focus.
It's It's good to be here.
Well, I guess the last time you were here was at the end of July, and it's been quite a full 6 months since then. And I wanted to start by a reference, this line I have, the thin green line, which is actually, I think, was coined by Eric Deplace at Sightline Institute. We're all using it now. So I wanted to start out by defining that for those people who've never heard the term before.
Yeah, what Eric is referring to is basically the idea that the West Coast of North America is a critical wall between huge carbon reserves and the markets that would burn them. And so he's sort of taken to referring to the West Coast of North America as the thin green line. And through our action, we can effectively keep the fossil fuels in the ground by not allowing very large export terminals for, as you said, coal, oil, propane, LNG, all of the above, from being exported.
So I want to start with the most recent assault, and then we can move backwards. And I guess we should probably move backwards to like early August of this past summer and kind of look at all the actions and how they maybe are culminating in an even more eventful year this year. But let's start with this not that much mentioned resolution that was slipped into the budget resolution, which basically lifts the ban on exporting crude oil in the United States. And maybe we should start by talking about what the ban was, because it wasn't actually a ban, as I understand it, totally, but how that lifting that quasi-ban will put more pressure here for the developments that the fossil fuel industry keeps proposing.
Yeah, Christmas came early for the oil industry, and it came in the form of Congress lifting what had been a prohibition on exporting oil that was unrefined to overseas markets. And so the law up until last week was that unrefined crude oil from the United States had to stay within the United States for to be refined, and then it could be exported. So it wasn't a total ban on exports. It was a ban on unrefined crude oil exports. By lifting that, that creates the potential for a project like Tesoro Savage's proposal in Vancouver, which is huge, at 360,000 barrels a day. It creates the potential for that project to be an exporter of raw, unrefined oil overseas. We see this as a huge threat, and it creates more and more pressure for these oil export terminals to go forward. It also peels back the sort of false public relations work of Tesoro, who has been claiming for 2 years that their oil was for U.S. consumers. At the same time, Tesoro was supporting the lifting of the oil export ban. And so now all the cards are on the table. We know what their project is. It's a huge oil export terminal, or at least has the potential to be, and that puts the work that we're doing as an entire region, all the folks who are involved in this, whether it's local businesses, tribes, firefighters, community activists, climate activists, we're making a big difference when we stop this terminal. And that's on our plate for 2016.
Well, I was thinking about the export, well, the liquid natural gas terminal that's been proposed off and on near Astoria for years. And originally it was going to be an import terminal because we needed the natural gas. And then with all the fracking that's been going on, we don't need the natural gas in this country. So it was going to be an export terminal. I'm wondering if there's a similar kind of scenario that might be playing out now with the Tesoro Savage oil terminal.
Yeah, absolutely. I was in Astoria last week talking with some of the activists there who are longtime veterans of the LNG fight. And they are still fighting a very large LNG export proposal in Warrenton right next to Astoria. And there'll be more happening on that in 2016. But when I sort of described the arc of Tesoro's proposal, that they had sold this as an American energy project, you know, American oil to American refiners using, you know, U.S. trains, and literally their website draped in the American flag, they started laughing because it was so similar to LNG. And so this bait and switch approach is one that we're very familiar with. And people in the Northwest are rejecting it. People in the Northwest have been standing up in enormous numbers and with a lot of efficacy in stopping these projects. 2015 was a landmark year. We really made a lot of progress. We are building a movement that's looking at all of these threats together, and we're not allowing ourselves to be siloed as much between liquefied natural gas and coal and oil and all these different projects. We're seeing now that keeping all of these fossil fuels in the ground is our goal. And as you said at the beginning, the thin green line, we have a disproportionate ability to make that happen because we live on the shortest route for these fossil fuels to their market.
let's just do a little bit of a geographical review. I know Eric's done it on the show a few times, and you have too. But just to reinforce for listeners, why is it the Pacific Northwest is the seen as the focus for exporting all this fossil fuel, and why is it such a potential chokehold?
There's just not that many easy ways to get very heavy trains to the coast. And the Columbia River Gorge provides one of the easiest paths. And so that's why we see everything involving, you know, oil by rail, propane by rail, coal by rail, all of that coming down the Columbia River. All the stuff that's being drilled out of Montana and even Canada and Wyoming, this huge region of the inland North American continent, that's all aimed towards Asia, ultimately, and all these markets in Asia that the fossil fuel producers are hoping to access. If we can stop these export terminals from happening in our Columbia River estuary or elsewhere on the Oregon and Washington coast, we have a huge impact in staving off the burning of these fossil fuels.
So why here as opposed to like going to the Gulf Coast or going some other route to get to markets?
They're trying both. That's for certain. We see already liquefied natural gas exports happening from the Gulf Coast, oil exports proposed. But for many of these producing fields of either gas or oil or propane, we're much closer. And so we are the cheaper route to get that stuff to markets that want to burn it.
I see another parallel, too, with the pipelines that are being proposed to go across Canada. And actually, let's talk about the Northern Gateway first, because we've talked on the show about that a lot. And my hunch is that that really is dead now. And I'm wondering what your sense is with the political changes that happened first in Alberta and then federally in Canada, and the tribes, the First Nations in Canada getting stronger and stronger federal judicial support to stop the pipelines, that at least the Northern Gateway is almost off the table. Does that, is that sort of correlate with what you're seeing?
I don't know, honestly, to say whether whether it's off the table that firmly. And I certainly hope so. The stand that the First Nations have taken is dramatic and obviously effective. It's stopped that pipeline from operating so far, and the political shift in Canada hopefully does portend for stopping these fossil fuel projects. But we're still early on. We don't know how much of the previous government's momentum will last into the Trudeau government. Trudeau didn't outrightly oppose the Keystone XL pipeline, although that's now sort of faltered and we think dead.
Well, he wasn't going to oppose, he wasn't going to declare war on the United States if Obama came out against it, which was kind of, right. Stephen Harper was sort of, it wasn't maybe going to be a hot war, but it certainly was going to be, he had a lot of rhetoric. Well, what I find interesting with Justin Trudeau, he hasn't come out against the Northern Gateway pipeline specifically, but I think he did make some very strong statements about not increasing tanker traffic, the big tankers in the Salish Sea and in the Pacific Ocean off the west coast of Canada. And that would preclude the Northern Gateway pipeline from being useful if you can't put that oil onto a tanker. So I'm wondering if that seems to you to be a very positive perspective.
It is positive, for sure. And it's a huge shift. And it, you know, for a long time, you know, we were building a lot of political momentum in Oregon and Washington to stop these projects, and British Columbia was really under the gun for these huge fossil fuel exports. And that is still very much the case. There are over a dozen liquefied natural gas export terminals proposed up and down the BC coast, many of which are in very remote areas, even more remote than, you know, the south coast of Oregon, which we think of as, you know, kind of a pretty rugged landscape for getting that pipeline up and over the coast range. It's even more so in BC.
Because actually, some of these places barely have roads. I mean, in order to get to, like even Kitimat, which is probably one of the larger communities that they were citing, that's where the terminus for the Northern Gateway pipeline would end. To get to Kitimat from Vancouver, if you want to drive, you have to go way inland and then come back. I was going to do it, actually. And I don't know, it's probably like a two-day drive. And it's not that many miles. It's just there's a lot of things in the way.
Yeah.
So before we get to kind of looking backwards through the summer, I just wanted to talk about another incident that happened recently. I saw you on the news in connection with this one. Mm-hmm. That happened here in Portland that raises, again, the ugly specter of oil trains. And that's the big accident that happened a couple weeks ago on Highway 30. So I saw you on the news talking about how this was a wake-up call. So let's talk about what that accident was and why it's so scary.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, someone was killed, which was obviously tragic. And
for people who missed it, yeah. I mean, there was a double hitch oil tanker truck basically that went off the road, Highway 30, and hit an oil train.
That's right. Yeah. So it slammed into a train that looked like it could have been carrying crude oil. It turns out the train was carrying asphalt, which is very heavy. And in this case, it didn't spill, didn't rupture the tank car so that it didn't burn.
Now, I'm curious, when they say asphalt, do they actually mean literally asphalt, processed asphalt? It wasn't bitumen. It was more refined than bitumen.
It was asphalt. Okay. That's right. And so when it slammed into the train, that would cause this huge fire, a sort of spectacular fire that unfortunately killed the driver of the truck, but burned for quite some time and sent this huge plume of smoke blowing right into St. John's. You know, I got calls from people who lived in St. John's saying the LNG tank looks like it's on fire, because all of this happened within, you know, about 100 yards of the liquefied natural gas storage tank near the St. John's Bridge. So it was very, very close to being the worst case possible scenario of having, you know, a tanker truck slam into an oil train and the shrapnel potentially piercing the LNG tank, which could have been, you know, a disaster that would have impacted a large area of North Portland, because the liquefied natural gas tank stores an enormous amount of supercooled LNG. If the train had been carrying Bakken crude, it very likely, you know, could have, you know, exploded and caught fire more dramatically. What's amazing is that the fire that ensued from that was all of the fuel that was in the truck. So you're looking at far less than what would be in a single tank car in an oil train. And that's what burned, and that's what caused Highway 30 to shut down for hours on end.
That was at least 14 hours, I think.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's, that's what makes it a wake-up call, is we see oil trains moving down the Columbia River and through Portland weekly. And I've called it Russian roulette, and I think that's pretty charged language, but I really feel that way. It's the issue that keeps us up at night. When is one of these trains going to end up in the river or end up derailing and exploding? Or in this case, through no fault of the train operator, a truck went off the highway and slammed into it. It's just a very dangerous commodity, this Bakken crude oil, to be moving over these distances and through populated areas.
Well, actually, I got a little bit of a close view of the resident's perspective on this. I happened to be going to a party on Sovie Island that night, and I live in Portland. Had to go through St. John's to get there, and got there, and I didn't know that at that point. All I knew, this was a big accident on Highway 30. I didn't know it was an oil train. I get there, and everybody who lives on the island is like very, very concerned about this, and my friend says, it hit an oil train, and then, well, no, there was no oil in the train. It was but it just was one of these worst-case scenario moments, and the people who lived in Sovie Island were really, really concerned, and it was very close to them. And then, of course, it was not that far across the river to St. John's. But we're looking at really populated areas. And then in addition with Sovie Island, it's a really important farming area, and there's wildlife, and there's a huge amount of habitat resources that would be threatened. And one of the things that I wondered is the city, DEQ says, well, there was no major pollution as a result of this burn. I mean, it burned for hours. And it reminds me of the Chevron Richmond refinery fire in 2012, where the Air Board in California was saying there was no noticeable increase in pollution from this fire that burned for 12 hours. So I wondered, again, is there some obfuscating going on the part of DEQ that sort of downplayed the potential pollution? I mean, I couldn't see the smoke by the time I got there, but I saw lots and lots of video of that smoke, and it was a really thick cloud, and it lingered for a very long time.
It did, and they rerouted a race that was going on at the time because of it. Yeah, I mean, I think that real-time monitoring is really challenging. But, you know, I think DEQ has much more to do with, at least from our perspective, on the front end, you know, they don't need to be sending out permits for terminals that pose these types of risks. And, you know, what we're looking at now is the potential to have over 100 oil trains a week barreling down the Columbia River Gorge carrying very volatile fuel, the type of fuel that actually burned in this case. I mean, it'd be carrying fuel that's almost as volatile as the gasoline that was in that truck that exploded and when it hit the train. And so it's, we're in a very critical time. And this has created an unusual dynamic where we're seeing more than just people who are concerned about the climate change impacts of oil by rail. We're seeing people who have very basic common sense public safety concerns. People who, for instance, live in the Fruit Valley neighborhood in Vancouver, who are saying if there's even a minor incident with a large release of just fumes that will impact that neighborhood very acutely. And there are people who live there who could be injured or killed by those toxic fumes. And so that kind of brings us now to look at what can we do to stop the flow of oil by rail. And the first big thing we can do is stop the biggest oil by rail facility proposed in North America. And the hearing about that is happening on January 5th. And that could very well be the largest hearing in recent history in Clark County.
For the largest oil facility in North America.
Yeah, it fits that people would turn out in large numbers. And if people are listening from Portland and are concerned about this project, you should absolutely attend. And people from all over the Northwest will be there too, not just comment, but to stand in solidarity with their friends in Southwest Washington who are fighting this, and from all over the region. It's obviously appropriate for everyone to comment and to come from all over the region, because this proposal would impact the whole region and even the global. It's a globally significant amount of carbon pollution. It actually registers on the global scale. It's that big. It's 42% of the Keystone XL pipeline in terms of volume. So Tesoro, you know, this proposal definitely focuses our attention on what's moving already too. And so that incident in North Portland made us think, you know, 4 or 5 of these trains coming per day, it's only a matter of time before something goes really wrong.
Well, if you're just tuning in this morning, we're talking with Conservation Director of the Columbia River Keeper, Dan Sears, and we've just been talking about the impacts of oil trains and the kind of wake-up call we have with the big accident on Highway 30 a couple of weeks ago with a truck running off the road and hitting an oil train that fortunately wasn't carrying oil at the time. And we're going to be talking in the rest of the show about looking back at a variety of actions that have happened in the past few months since Dan was on the show in July, and looking at how this is building momentum. Oh, there's momentum actually building on both sides, I think, to make the Northwest a major export hub for fossil fuels, or to prevent that from happening. Let's go back to July. When you were here in July, the big concern was liquid natural gas, and you were lobbying our then recently appointed Governor Kate Brown to take a stand on it. So what has happened with that? Has Kate Brown come on board yet on trying to slow or stop the export of liquid natural gas in Oregon?
Kate Brown, our governor, has not tipped her hand on how she's going to approach this. What she said so far is that she plans to direct all her agencies to follow the law and to essentially make the important decisions at an agency level. In sort of simple terms, we realize that the agencies work for Kate Brown and they will follow her direction. And to be even blunter about it, you know, we elect governors to make tough decisions like those about huge fossil fuel export projects. And so Kate Brown isn't going to be able to escape her responsibility for whatever happens. So where things stand right now, the Coos Bay LNG project and its related Pacific Connector pipeline are actively seeking multiple state permits, particularly those from Department of State lands. And these are very, very important. The state has enormous authority and wide latitude to simply turn this project down, or it could make a more narrow decision that says, well, you've put the pipeline in the wrong place. And that's happening right now. We expect a decision by February 8th. And so right now people are weighing in with state agencies urging them to turn this project down. They're weighing in with the governor saying you should be, you know, leaning on your agencies to make the right call here. And what's at stake is really the integrity of Coos Bay as an estuary, where they want to do an enormous amount of dredging and then plow the pipeline right through very sensitive oyster beds in Coos Bay. And I didn't really realize how dramatic the impact was until we got a chance to hear from Lily Clausen, who came to the Department of State Lands recently in December and spoke to them about the impact on the oyster beds in Coos Bay. It just seems reckless and unnecessary to put the pipeline in that particular spot. And that was kind of her perspective, but it's a symptom of the larger recklessness of the proposal as a whole, which, you know, proposing a massive new pipeline across Oregon, it would be one of the largest clear-cut projects we've seen in recent history in Oregon, of over 1,000 acres of late successional forest being cleared along the pipeline route. It would be the largest dredging project in the history of Oregon for a single purpose dock. It would be the largest emitter of greenhouse gas pollutants as soon as basically the coal plant in Boardman went offline. And there are two of these proposals right now in Oregon. One in Coos Bay is a little bit ahead of the one in Warrenton, but that one in Warrenton near Astoria is also seeking permits. So where we are now is very similar to where we were in mid-2015. We are looking for state agencies and our governor to make the clear decision to stop these projects. It's been, we are entering our 11th year of fighting liquefied natural gas. As you said at the top, they started as import projects. They're now export. And despite all the pressure, despite all of the time that's passed, at this point, over 90% of the people who live along the pipeline in Southern Oregon have refused access to their property for the project. These aren't climate activists. These are, you know, folks who live out in rural Oregon, some of whom are climate activists, but many of whom are rural farmers, foresters, people who fish in the rivers, people who hunt, and people who rely on having a healthy ecosystem around them. And they're flat out saying no to Pacific Connector. And that's very inspiring, I think, to me personally, just to see people standing their ground after all this time.
Now, if they say, no, you can't come on our land, is there the next step eminent domain, or do they actually have a final say on whether or not the pipeline can cross
the property?
It could
be. Yeah. In that case, Pacific Connector would, once they get an approval from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, have the right of eminent domain. And that's why we're focused so much on the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon has a property right involved in this. They don't have to allow the Pacific Connector to use the bed of Coos Bay through these oyster beds. They can say no to that under their own proprietary authority. They have the type of property right that average Oregonians wish they had and wish they could use to just say no to the pipeline. But even FERC is taking notice of the fact that so many people are saying no to the project. They asked Pacific Connector to answer two questions. One, who's their customer? And two, do they have anyone signed on the pipeline route? And Pacific Connector said, well, the customer is coming very soon, as they've been saying for 2 years, and we have less than 10% of the pipeline signed. I think it's actually 3.4% by land is signed and under easement for Pacific Connector. And that's after over a decade of effort. And so I think Oregonians are holding fast, and that's really encouraging. But 2016 is going to be a really critical time to make sure that Governor Brown does the right thing, that Treasurer Wheeler does the right thing, that Secretary of State Gene Atkins does the right thing. As the state land board, these folks could weigh in on this directly. They haven't chosen to do that just yet, but they are all ultimately responsible for what happens with the Department of State Lands and their decision on whether or not the Pacific Connector gets to use Oregon's public lands and public waters.
Well, I'm thinking about the politics that's going on right now. Kate Brown is running for election, since she wasn't elected right to begin with. And I'm a little confused, actually, because the election isn't actually for two more years, but I keep getting these campaign emails from her.
She has to run.
Oh, she has to run in 2016?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Then that explains the urgency on her part.
Yes.
So it's this couple of things that she might be looking at. One was that there was so much pressure put on her office around the Nestle bottling water plant and some sleight of hands that the Fish and Wildlife and the State Land Board did, that she reversed herself on that one. And now it's all, that whole process is going through public review, which made the activists much happier. And some of that pressure might have come from the ballot initiative that's going to be on the ballot in Hood River to ban bottling water in Hood River County. The other political lesson, I'm wondering if she's watching what happened with Charlie Hales, when he was pushing the Pembina liquid propane terminal here in Portland and then did a total about face and admitted that he wouldn't have gotten reelected if he pushed it, and then he decided not to run for reelection after all. And I just wonder if that kind of pressure, if you hear any rumblings that this stuff is like percolating in Kate Brown's political mind as well.
I mean, it has to be. And we know that the biggest supporter of this project is the building trades, and they are pushing hard for the Jordan Cove LNG project. They see it as a way to create those pipe fitting and IBEW jobs that are, you know, that they seek. And I certainly understand that there are a lot of temporary jobs to be gained from that. We just have to find better ways of creating those jobs than, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul, essentially, to doing so much damage to the streams and wetlands and doing so much damage to these families who own land along these pipeline routes. On the Columbia River, it's it's hard to figure out who's in favor of this project. It seems to enjoy almost no political support. And yet, we've seen very little action from the state of Oregon to turn that project down. You can't really go through the process in any cleaner or fashion or in better faith than the good people of Clatsop County have done. You know, they voted in a county commission that turned down the pipeline. They've put pressure on state agencies. They've made it clear that this project, you know, through a direct vote of Clatsop County, there's a 2/3 vote against the project LNG in Clatsop County. And yet the state has not acted. They have not rejected the project. And Oregon LNG remains sort of looming as this threat over the Columbia River estuary. And it's much more urgent in Coos Bay, where Veresen, the company behind this project, is desperate to get this project moving. And so, yes, there's a lot of pressure politically on Cape Brown to make particularly the Coos Bay project happen. But there is a huge and mounting pressure for Curd not to allow it to happen, primarily because it's going to be a ripoff for Southern Oregonians who have seen pipeline construction and have seen it create no jobs before. There was one built in Coos County in the early 2000s that's created essentially no economic benefit for the county, except for the money they're getting paid by the LNG developer to keep that pipeline empty currently. And then there's the huge climate impact that's really come to light with LNG. The fact that the Jordan Cove LNG project and the Oregon LNG project, each on their own, would be the biggest polluters in the state in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. That's something that's finally getting through to our elected officials. They're realizing that there is a real, there's a false narrative about LNG that it's somehow better than coal. It's not. It's just flat out not better than coal.
It's better than coal in the actual burning of it, I guess.
Right.
But if you look at the life cycle, then it's some issues.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at how much methane is released during the production and transmission of this stuff, that the methane leakage, like the catastrophic methane leak that's going on right now in near Los Angeles, points to the fact that there's a huge, huge carbon penalty with all of these fossil fuels. And liquefied natural gas is one of the worst.
It seems like bringing up that methane leak near Los Angeles, that there's so many lessons going on right now about why this is the wrong direction. Do you see that there's any awakening on the part of elected officials and other people that might have been tacitly supporting these projects to realize the real downside of them?
You know, I take a lot of heart from watching Charlie Hales change his position on Pembina and go from being someone who is touting a fossil fuel project to being a very active leader explaining why we need to keep fossil fuels in the ground.
It's from meeting the Pope, I guess.
Yeah, whatever it took, it worked. Yeah, and it's really encouraging to see that people are having very genuine changes of heart and are looking at the fossil fuel issue differently than they did years ago or even months ago. And that was the shift we've seen in 2015. I was just trying to make a list in my mind of all the different fossil fuel projects that had some, you know, big critical decision point, you know, from stopping Connect Oregon funding going to a potential coal port at Port Westward, to stopping the Pembina propane export terminal in Portland, to holding our ground on LNG and starting really to push back on the Jordan Cove project. Now with these oil terminals that are all trying to gain traction with the oil export ban being lifted, 2015 definitely set the stage for kind of these battles to continue in 2016.
Well, actually, kind of in the big picture, long term, we also contributed to having Shell pull out of drilling for oil in the Arctic.
Absolutely. Yeah, I forgot that one.
That was kind of big.
Yeah, that was the most spectacular of all of them in many ways.
And actually, I want to talk a little bit about that because, that was the one struggle that made it into international news. And it had some incredible images, I think, you know, that went around the world that still in people's minds of the Greenpeace climbers dangling from the St. John's Bridge with these incredible yellow and red banners. But what was it about that action, do you think, that maybe it could be seen as a turning point, both in how the climate movement operates and the impact that it's actually having on the oil industry? Because, I mean, besides Shell, I guess a couple other oil companies have also pulled out of the Arctic now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what I think it showed is that people are willing to take action where they are to help affect this change. And so it showed that we as a region will be willing to step up and take action on something that's even far away. That's up in Alaska, far, far from where we are. And it gives me hope that people will be willing to take strong actions, whether it's going to a hearing or you know, whatever it takes in the end to stop these fossil fuel projects here in the Pacific Northwest. People are really stepping up, and it's we're going to hit the ground running in 2016. The hearing on the Tesoro Savage project will be a really important point for us to make a statement that we are turning in a different direction than these huge fossil fuel export projects.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that towards the end of the show. One of the places where I get into some of my more interesting political discussions is at the dog park. And there's this guy that I run into quite frequently. And I was talking about all the effort to stop all these different fossil fuel projects. And he was being very skeptical that it was going to really work. And he said, well, he didn't think that even if the state of Oregon or the city of Portland made any kind of, passed any ordinances, it's federal jurisdiction and it wouldn't make any difference. So I wonder, what do you say to this cynic about that ultimately it's that we don't at the local and state level have any jurisdiction over really stopping these proposals?
Well, I just say that history shows he's wrong. We've stopped terminals. We stopped the Pembina project. We stopped the Bradwood LNG terminal on the Lower Columbia River, which in many ways was one of the first big fossil fuel victories we had. We've stemmed the tide of these projects coming forward, at least on the coal front. You know, we have a major victory over the coal export terminal proposed in Morrow. We think that project will not move forward. It's under appeal right now, but it's effectively dead for the time being. Arch Coal is on the verge of bankruptcy. So when these proposals fail to make progress and when they're canceled, it has an impact on the industry as a whole. And we're seeing that dramatically with the coal industry right now, where their last gasp is exporting coal to Asia. That's the only way that they're going to be able to keep afloat. They're going to make their creditors whole. And so the work we're doing here is going to ultimately have a big impact on the amount of coal that gets mined as a whole. And so the local action at the local, state, and federal level, to the extent that we can get our federal delegation to weigh in, is very, very important. And when it comes to a lot of these projects, the authority is with the states. When it comes to the Tesoro Savage oil terminal in Vancouver, it literally comes down to the Energy Facilities Site Evaluation Council for the state of Washington, and they make a recommendation to Governor Inslee, and he makes a final decision. So it's that simple. In the state of Oregon, if the state land board or any of these agencies that have to issue permits for the project, if they were to say, no, this LNG project in Coos Bay or this LNG project in Warrenton is unacceptable, doesn't meet the state's standards, it stops. That's it. It's over. And that's what we saw with Bradwood. When DEQ turned the project down, they couldn't get any investors to pick up a bankrupt project, and the whole thing went away.
Well, I'm just thinking about a year ago, we had a different governor
with some
different interests, and I'm wondering if you see a shift. I mean, I was thinking about state land board, and I do believe that there was a person on the state land board who came out very strongly against the coal terminal at Morrow, and then she lost her job.
That was the Oregon Department of Transportation, okay. Commission.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
So do you think that things have changed, even though Kate Brown is not, she's still holding her cards rather close to her chest, but she, do you think that there's a difference in basically who is on the councils and the different boards that would make the decisions now, that there is a different climate in Oregon than there was under Kitzhaber that might indicate there's a shift in policy?
Well, we certainly hope so. We are currently in an interim director for the Department of State Lands, and they're making the very important decisions right now about liquefied natural gas in Coos Bay. And so we're really looking, you know, at her, Stephanie Hallett-Cummins, as the decision maker right now for the Department of State Lands, but she answers to the State Land Board. And Governor Brown is committed to being more transparent and to make sure that the agencies follow the laws. And we think actually if they do that, if they actually follow the law to the letter, then you're really not allowed to put a huge pipeline through the middle of oyster beds. Like, that's one proposal conflicting with an existing use that is protected under state law, and the state could use its authority and use its discretion to say, no, you can't put the pipeline there. And then the project doesn't move forward, at least in that location, and would require a major reworking. And so this is the type of thing that we're looking at with Kate Brown is, Is she willing to take even the incremental steps to protect the state from the worst impacts of these really crazy projects? One thing we do know is that Governor Kitzhaber, former Governor Kitzhaber, was a big proponent of liquefied natural gas exports. And he really had a false sense that there was some big climate advantage to exporting LNG all over the world over burning coal.
Didn't he also have some business interests that, at least that's some rumors I heard. But.
Yeah, I can't speak to that directly because I'm not sure. But, you know, going back to the emails of the governor's staff, it's very clear that there was this hope that Oregon would become a trafficker of clean natural gas to the entire, you know, the Pacific Rim, if not the world. I mean, they were swinging big with the Jordan Cove LNG project and very, very supportive of that, that particular proposal. And Governor Brown, to her credit, has stepped back and is not following that particular course of action, as far as we can tell. And so it's up to us to make sure that in 2016, this is the year that many critical decisions will be made, that the right ones are made for the people of Oregon and for our climate. To give you a sense, you know, there are hearings happening in the first week of January. There'll be a hearing on January 6th in Medford and January 7th in North Bend about whether or not the state will issue removal fill permits to cross hundreds of streams and rivers and wetlands for the Pacific Connector pipeline to ship LNG overseas. DSL is holding those hearings right off the bat. And if you're listening to this and you're interested in supporting the LNG fight, sending a comment to Department of State Lands and attending those hearings are two very important ways to do that.
Well, let's get back to the hearing you keep alluding to. That's going to be next week in Ridgefield, Washington. And I have there's a link on the Locus Focus website for this program that it's basically a call to action, and it's in bold, large font, and it'll take you to a page on the Columbia River Keeper where you can find out more and sign up to comment. So let's talk about that. What's going to happen on January 5th, and how do people get involved?
So on January 5th, there'll be a hearing conducted by the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council for Washington. And what they will be doing is essentially taking input on the draft environmental impact statement for the Tesoro Savage project. They call themselves the Vancouver Energy Distribution Terminal. We've refused to call them that. Call them Tesoro Savage. It sounds
like
what it is. Yeah. You know, it sounds a little bit more like a dirty oil terminal. And we're expecting hundreds of people to be there. If you're listening, if you're picking one hearing to go to in the local area, this will be a big one. We expect people to show up in red shirts to give eloquent testimony as they have so many times before, and to really demonstrate the breadth of the coalition that's fighting this particular project. So the Tesoro terminal, as proposed, would ship 360,000 barrels of oil a day. That's almost half the size of the Keystone XL pipeline, but it wouldn't do it with a pipeline. It would do it with these crazy trains that keep derailing, spilling, and exploding. We've seen over a dozen derailments and explosions since the 2013 disaster in Lac Mégantic, Quebec, that killed 47 people. And so these are the images that are in people's minds as they go to these hearings and they try to persuade the state of Washington to do the right thing. In this case, the draft environmental impact statement clearly supports the conclusion of turning this project down. There's enough information in the EIS to say that there are significant impacts, like a train derailment near the Columbia River, or a train derailment in downtown Spokane or downtown Vancouver, or in any one of these little towns along the gorge, that these impacts would be significant and couldn't be mitigated. And so that is grounds for the state, for EFSEC, the council, to recommend denial, and ultimately for Governor Inslee, or whoever is the governor in 2017, to make the right decision and to turn the project down. It's by far the largest oil-by-rail terminal in the Northwest that's proposed. It is, to our knowledge, the largest proposal in North America. It would involve up to 5 loaded, mile-long unit trains full of highly volatile Bakken crude oil coming down the Columbia River Gorge every day. And so this is a big one, and we want to meet the size of this proposal with an equal and greater force of popular opposition, and that's our goal on January 5th.
Okay, and where do people go?
Go to, you can find more information at ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org or StandUpToOil.org, and we'll be meeting at the Clark County Event Center at the fairgrounds in Clark County. It's in Ridgefield, just a little bit north of Vancouver. It's the exit right after I-5 and 205 meet going north. The hearing will be in Hall B. It's on 17402 Northeast Delfell Road in Ridgefield. The hearing begins at 1 p.m. and runs until the last speaker has spoken. So if you want to come and you have something to say about oil trains, you can either speak to your reading of this environmental impact statement, or you can speak to your own experience and how this project would impact you and the river you care about. So it's going to be, it's going to put on display the fact that we have an unusual alliance of businesses, of tribal nations, and many others who are fighting this project.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Dan. It's always good to have you on the show, and we'll come check back in a few months. And
just as my voice runs out.
So. Right, yeah, just in time. We've been talking this morning with Dan Sears, who's the Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, Dominic Della Sala with the Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon, returns to Locus Focus along with Chad Hansen to talk about the ecological importance of mixed severity fires in our forests. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with Tom Waits singing some music for the new year. Happy New Year, and thanks for listening.
I scolded your driver and your brother. We're old enough to know.
And it's 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Grace Reed hosts Disability Awareness. That is followed at 11:30 by Voices for the Animals. Host Dab Stedman talks with Gail Hunt about her efforts to help wild horses survive in Oregon. Thanks, KBOO members, for your great and generous support for this radio station. If you are not a current member or you want to increase your current donation, please take advantage of our end-of-the-year matching grant by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
I'm David Barsamian, host of Alternative Radio, heard every Tuesday morning at 9 on KBOO. KBOO currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. If you become a member at this time or increase